time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Hey, John, how's it going, my friend?
Good, Sean. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, always great to see you and hear what you've got to say. How is the book doing?
It's doing well. Yeah, it's I keep writing articles related to MKUltra because sadly there is so many MKUltra projects still going on today. It appears a recent article I wrote was about this Father Maskell and this documentary called The Keepers about this priest who was abusing tons of young women, teen women in a Catholic high school, and turns out have many connections to MKUltra, the CIA's MKUltra program. And of course, Drugs as Weapons Against Us, my book and film, are both about MKUltra, about the use of drugs for unconventional warfare. And so, because this guy was apparently using, drugs, including LSD, hypnosis, and raping and selling these teen girls to politicians and police and other priests around the city and actually further around the East Coast. So it was, and this documentary about it called The Keepers was nominated for an Academy Award for documentary in our country. So yeah, it's big news.
Congratulations. We have had some people on commenting on that over the years. But John, a lot of our viewers perhaps are not familiar with MKUltra. Could you just let them know how it started?
Yeah, so MKUltra was started in 1953. It was a consolidation, an umbrella project of several others programs that were already going on, such as Artichoke and Bluebird. These were CIA projects that were trying to figure out ways to use drugs to control people. And and other projects for the control of people to, use them as assets, to manipulate them in different ways, to use them for blackmail, basically also develop dissociative identity disorder because of the drugs coupled with serious sexual abuse of kids anywhere from age 3 to, 18. Particularly 3 to 8 years old, though, can cause dissociative disorder, dissociative identity disorder. And people may not know those terms, but it used to be dissociative identity disorder used to be called multiple personality disorder. And so these women or men who develop this disorder can then be used as assets with one of their personalities doing things that another of their personalities doesn't even remember them doing, where they can be, manipulated in dissociative states to do things that they don't remember doing. And so that's just some of one part of MKUltra. But in my book, I showed how MKUltra started in 1953. And then in 1961, President John F. Kennedy, who I hope to talk about today too with you, basically closed down MKUltra and really tried to disintegrate the whole CIA, he had said at some point. But he closed down MKUltra. They ran it behind his back, but he tried to close it down a second time before he was assassinated, and they just changed its name to MK Search and kept it going at least until the mid-1970s when the U.S. Senate Church Committee investigated it and tried to expose much of it, which they did in a number of reports, and which were somewhat echoed in some mainstream media, but not a lot. Most mainstream media didn't touch this issue for fear of the CIA's, in their work with them and their control of the media, that, things would happen to them as individual journalists and happen to their career. But, I showed the evidence that MKUltra, like other U.S. intelligence programs, such as the FBI's counterintelligence program, kept going, at least until, you know, one with FBI whistleblower said it went at least until the 1990s. And I show evidence that they keep going until today. So,
John, I'm just wondering if these people who go through MK Ultra are terminated when their usefulness has expired, or are there any perhaps survivors of it that we could speak to, or maybe you've reached out to?
Yeah, well, look, I did a personal interview with one of the survivors of this Father Maskell situation. And this woman said that, you know, they used hypnosis and forced LSD on her. First, this priest in her school kept, you know, giving her drinks dosed with LSD, and then manipulated a friend of hers, a really big friend of hers, to force LSD on her in different ways. And she says that she was always worried, as well as a friend of hers who also went through this kind of abuse by Maskell and others, that they were programmed to react and do something to certain, you know, signals and certain, you know, numbers that they might hear. And so she seemed to be a victim who got out of it through extensive therapy. Sorry about that. I'm going to turn this off. Through extensive therapy. And yeah, that's what it takes to get out of it. But and that's what I do. I do psychotherapy for a living, and I've helped a number of trauma victims with something called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. But, you know, she's just one of God knows how many that are still alive today, though she's, you know, gotten in recovery. But people like Courtney Love is most likely a victim of this kind of MKUltra, and, you know, the evidence is that she's part of it all and just doesn't know she's still part of it all and is still wrecking havoc. As so, for example, in the Jeff Epstein sex trafficking cases, she was in his black book. She was one of the only women that was circled as a material witness to a lot of things that happened. And so I can talk to you more about that and the new evidence regarding Kurt Cobain's case, you know, in that situation.
Yeah, we'll get to that. One of the viewers is asking if you've heard of Kathy O'Brien. I'm assuming she's perhaps an MKUltra survivor.
Yeah, she is a survivor. And I've seen her videos and, you know, heard her talk about it. And she seems very credible. And she talks about some of the things that happened to her and some of the ways the traumas like heightened her senses. They increased her vision. They increased her memory. And basically what happens is when we're traumatized, it puts us into this vigilant, you know, intense, you know, kind of awareness, you know, like in fear that we're going to be traumatized again. And so it causes us to use, you know, to expand the use of our brain, to use more of it. And that's why people can be in hyper alert situations, have a better memory, have improved eyesight, to be hyper aware, you know, wide open eyes, hyper aware of what's going on, to try to, you know, be vigilant about something happening again. And I think, you know, she is a very interesting case in that regard and talking about it. And it's great that she has been speaking out. I don't know her story in extensive detail because I investigated other stories, but I think she is a very credible witness on it all.
We've been asked whether Britney Spears has gone through something like this.
Yeah, I for her, I didn't, you know, look at her case intensively, but I do believe that she is a case of, you know, ritual abuse from early on, from early childhood. And the way she was assaulted was, you know, what I believe she was assaulted was as part of the Disney's traveling, you know, actors and musicians and, you know, performers. Disney has a traveling national network of young performers. And I counseled a woman who was part of that, those national performers, and who clearly had some kind of dissociative disorder going on. She was had an addiction going on. She was, you know, director of a regional theater and had extensive problems. And I can't, of course, talk, you know, about very personal details about her because I can't, you know, reveal things about clients. But she just was one example of, you know, she of child abuse, through Disney's National Performing Network. And there's just, you know, I've heard of a number of other performers that were abused by their coaches, their you know, Disney coaches in those National Performing Networks. And they have dissociative disorder, they have addiction issues. And you know, from what I've seen about Britney Spears, she shows the, you know, kind of the behaviors of that for sure.
Right. I'm going to ask the viewers a quick question then. Do you want us to start with Kurt Cobain? Put one in the chat. If you want us to start with JFK, put two in the chat. And all of John's links are in the description box below this video. So please support his work. How many books have you written now?
So, Sean, yeah, I wrote two books, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, which was kind of bought out by, or just really just taken by a new publisher and transformed into the, just The FBI War on Tupac Shakur, : State Repression of Black Leaders. Then I wrote, the second book I wrote was Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the CIA, you know, War on Musicians and Activists. Of course, it has a longer title, which you mentioned, which I appreciate. But then I turned those two books into films. And then, of course, wrote another film and produced another film that shot Two Janks the Pandemics. But so I think that the, you know, the key things I've been focusing on are U.S. intelligence, and particularly with around musicians and other activists and the way that affects the population.
It's almost unanimous for Kurt Cobain. So let's just, because a lot of people haven't seen you before on the channel, John, let's go over the basics first.
Sure, sure. So Cobain won. That was very democratic of you, Sean. So, well, regarding Kurt Cobain, he was a kind of a activist, anti-war and civil rights activist inside. You know, he was just an activist at heart, I believe. He stated a lot of, you know, pro kind of activist causes early on from the start of his career, saying, you know, he knew about the media and how mainstream media was just basically controlled. And so he wouldn't wear, you know, wouldn't get on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine unless they allowed him to wear a t-shirt that says corporate magazines still suck. And of course, that's why it's so good to have media like yours, Sean, that helps get the word out. But he also had said in an interview that ended up in a book that was a biography of Nirvana before Kurt Cobain died, that he said that he originally wanted to put all kinds of anarchist essays and revolutionary essays on the cover of Nevermind. You know, Nirvana's album Nevermind, which was a best-selling album, of course, but he said we better hold off on that. You know, I want to get more popular first, so people take it more seriously. And so, you know, and he mocked capitalist record, you know, label owners about them just being, you know, wealthy and greedy. And he supported causes for abortion rights. He supported causes, you know, anti-war kind of things. He talked about just a lot of good issues. And he says he doesn't want anyone in his crowd that's racist. He doesn't want any one in his crowd that's sexist. And so he just had a lot of views that he expressed, activist views he expressed. And the band, after he died, ended up supporting the kind of strike, the big protest for workers against the you know, World Trade Organization when they were meeting in Seattle, I believe it was, not maybe a year after, a few years after Cobain died. And with, you know, if Cobain was part of that, you know, kind of, you know, big rally and protests, of course, that would have been much more important and bigger. But of course, without Cobain, Nirvana just wasn't the same. And of course, they disbanded. But so I think that the key about him is that he, sadly enough, was duped by Courtney Love into getting involved in heroin because he had this massive stomach problem. And the opiates really solved his stomach problem temporarily, because he did not have a daily habit before he met Courtney. He said in his diaries, he said he only tried heroin about three or four times, and just because he was so desperate, he was throwing up all the time and his stomach.
John, I'm just going to stop you briefly. Oh, for the purposes of this interview, then, Are we all right to say white, brown, and green instead of the actual words? Otherwise, YouTube will stop us. It won't share the video.
Sure. White, brown, and green for what?
Yeah, for the various substances. So.
Sure.
Yeah,
no problem.
Yeah.
So I'd say he was so Courtney Love started having him inject white regularly, daily, and he he did develop a problem, and she meanwhile grew up in a super wealthy family. She was her mother admitted in a biography that she was probably abused from the ages of about 3 years old onwards. She said she wrote a letter to her biological father saying she was sexually and physically abused by her therapist from early on, and she was seeing therapists from the age of about 3 or 4 years old onwards. And so, that can cause dissociative identity disorder. And meanwhile, by the time she was a teenager, she was a prostitute. She admitted being a prostitute in letters. And she was a prostitute for Asian mafia, believe it or not. She said this in an authorized biography, that she was part of the white sex trade, white slave trade, she said, in I believe it was Japan at the time. And she also, it came out in major biographies of her, that she brought 1,000 hits of LSD to England when she was 17 years old. And why did she do that? Was she just, selling, an opportunist trying to sell drugs? But what we find out from her biological father is the fact that he says he had letters to prove it. Now he's passed now, Hank Harrison, but he said he incidentally introduced Courtney Love to a guy named Stephen O'Leary when she was 17 years old and visited him in Ireland. And Stephen O'Leary was working for the government, making weekly reports to the embassy in Ireland, to the U.S. embassy in Ireland, about things he was spying on in Ireland. And so he said he admitted on his deathbed all this, and that he was traveling with Courtney to England. He took her to England, where she passed out this, thousands hits of LSD, disrupted bands, disrupted the Pogues, slept with the drummer, and slept with loads of different musicians and musicians, from these, like Adam Ant and these other up and coming bands from England who made it big, were really despised her being over there and passing out so many different drugs. Now, go back 30 years from now, this was in the 1980s, and you go back, as I say, about maybe 40 years or so, and you see that what happened with MKUltra is the assistant director, a guy named Robert Lashbrook, according to Ernest Hemingway's editor, A.E. Hotchner, who came out with a biography of the Rolling Stones and the whole music scene in England, he says Robert Lashbrook took tons of LSD, agents, and money to London in 1965 as part of MKUltra, and tried to get them LSD in as many musicians' hands as possible. So here is Courtney Love duplicating that activity, that behavior. And the reason, obviously, is to manipulate and disrupt things and use the musicians who are beloved by many to popularize acid, to disrupt people's minds with acid. And so I show all kinds of evidence of that throughout my book. But with Courtney Love, she ended up doing it in London. Then she ended up, in England. And she ended up doing it in Manchester, I believe it was. But she ended up doing it through many top music scenes in the United States. She went through to Portland, she went to Los Angeles, she went to obviously Seattle, and did the same thing, passed out drugs like candy, LSD, opiates, painkillers, all kinds of things. She had tons of drugs on her all the time, just as a teenager. Where does this woman get so many different drugs? And then she married the top punk musician in Los Angeles, who thought, he thought he was marrying a left-wing rebellious woman, and it turns out he called her a right-wing Phyllis Diller. She said she slept with generals, army generals in Alaska, and they told her why wars are good for us, good for America. And so she was just, ridiculous, and he finally got away from her and divorced her, and then she goes and finds the top musician in Seattle, who was, of course, Kurt Cobain. and latches onto him when Nirvana's Nevermind was rising up the charts really fast, and convinces him to, you know, use heroin daily. But a year before he died, Cobain got off of heroin. He found a cure for a stomach problem. He said this in interviews, and he found a cure for his stomach problem. And a month before his death, Cobain's death, he had gone to the hospital in Rome. He overdosed on Rohypnol, and it was Courtney's prescription Rohypnol that she got, because it's legal in England. It's not legal in the United States. And Rohypnol's roofies, it's sleeping medication, but they're called roofies because people use them to put them in people's drinks, and they don't.
My place in tech changes every day. But I don't fear the future, because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts, so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
What happened, but they're passed out from the Rohypnol, the roofies, and then, you know, they rape them, you know, and it's horrible. But so she apparently put tons of roofies or Rohypnol in his drink. He had went into a coma, and people acted like it was a suicide attempt, but it was her Rohypnol. They found no other illicit drugs whatsoever in Cobain's body at that time, even though he was on tour with Nirvana through Europe. And this was, you know, in Italy at the time, he was playing concerts in Italy. And everyone said that he was not using any drugs. All the musicians were smoking weed or drinking, and he wasn't touching anything. And he was divorcing Courtney at the time. He just wanted to see his daughter, and Courtney had his daughter. So she brought the daughter over to see him. And so it's really, that was probably first murder attempt number one. And then, the second time, of course, worked. Now, we've got witnesses such as musician Eldon Hoke, who said she offered him some $60,000 to kill Kurt Cobain, gave him a map of how to find him in the house and everything else of Seattle. And she, now the news on this whole case came out recently, with, you know, let's say 6 to 12 months, I'll say, where the FBI finally released some documents they had on Kurt Cobain. So he released about 10 or 12 documents, pages of their file on Kurt Cobain. Now, why they have a file on Kurt Cobain is, you know, another story, of course, and it's a big story. But they have a file. It's obviously they have many more pages than the 10 to 12 pages I read. And they were getting all kinds of information from different sources that you've got to investigate, you know, Kurt Cobain's death, because it appears to be a murder and not a suicide. And so it turns out at the time of Cobain's death, Courtney Love hired a detective, Tom Grant, who was a private detective, was formerly a murder detective for the Los Angeles County Police Department. Tom Grant ends up finding loads of information and loads of evidence that Courtney Love played a part in her husband's death. And he took it all to the Los Angeles Police Department he used to work with, to the Seattle Police Department, who just ignored him. And, and nobody would look at it. Nobody would, you know, take it seriously. And so here was the FBI getting lots of this information too. And Unsolved Mysteries did some work on this case and hired the top forensic examiner, Cyril Wecht, to look at the case. And he said he highly believed that Kurt Cobain's death was staged as a suicide to hide that it was a homicide. You know, it was definitely a homicide, he believed. And he was the former head of the American Forensics Association, you know, for studying people, you know, deaths. And so this is just some of the evidence that Kurt Cobain was actually murdered and not, you know, wasn't a suicide. Now, so FBI says that they can't investigate this because it's not in their jurisdiction. And, you know, they say people have to cross state lines for them to investigate. And when they cross state lines, they don't have to murder anyone. Cross state lines of murdering anyone. They just have to plan to murder someone. So Courtney Love went from Seattle. Eldon Hoke said on tape for Nick Broomfield's film, Kurt and Courtney, that that Courtney Love came from Seattle, Los Angeles, visited him in his record store, and offered him $60,000 to kill Kurt Cobain. And that's all on film. And so state lines were crossed. The plan was made for murder. And the FBI says they can't investigate it. It's a joke. And so the FBI is covering up, obviously, for, you know, higher intelligence, you know, agents like CIA. And so the obvious thing that was going on, and this was a pattern amongst musicians, is they tried to manipulate Kurt Cobain to promote heroin, which he did inadvertently. He didn't want to, but, you know, of course, the media talking about him using did promote heroin, and use in America went up drastically every year during the 90s, from 91, 92, 93, 10% a year. And we have this heroin chic and all over here, and it's probably worldwide, of course. And but when, you know, then when he sobered up, he was a concern for promoting sobriety and activism. And he had to be done away with, sadly enough. And that's what, you know, appeared to happen. Now, the other evidence, of course, against Courtney Love is the fact that, I mean, there's more that I'm going to be coming out with in a sequel to my Drugs as Weapons Against This film. But the other evidence is the fact that, you know, as I said before, that Courtney Love ends up as one of the circled witnesses in Jeff Epstein's Black Book. Okay, Jeff Epstein, you know, the sex trafficker and all.
Yeah, we're banned from talking about that case on this channel, John.
Oh, no worries, no more talk about it.
YouTube terminated my channel twice over it completely.
And no more talk about it then. And this is what the world we live in now.
Public had to lobby to get the channel back. Yeah, it was a crazy situation. All right, so let me just talk to the viewers then. So, viewers, we are talking to John Potash about the mysterious death of Kurt Cobain and the role of the CIA and Courtney Love in it. If you've got any questions for John about this subject, because he is an expert on a lot of subjects, about Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love and the CIA, if you've got any questions for John, please put them in the chat. And we'll get them to him before we go over to other conspiracies, including JFK. So the first question that's coming in, John, is it because she had friends in high places that she did not face any consequences for this?
Yeah, so I think she did have friends in high places, but I believe that she probably, because of her childhood abuse, and a lot of things I read about her, she probably was suffering from dissociative disorder or dissociative identity disorder. I can't go through all, I don't have time to go through all the evidence of that, but I am a licensed psychotherapist, in network with many insurance companies, and trauma is my specialty. And so I've seen different signs of dissociative disorder, and she appears to exhibit them. And so she probably didn't even know everything she was doing. And so she was probably being handled and was the puppet of these higher authorities. She had, you know, they call them handlers that she had in her life. And in my next film, you can see, just even in my first film, you can hear some names of what might have been her handlers. But my next film goes in a little bit more, touches a little bit more on those handlers that are still with her, you know, can be seen with her in videos today.
Loads of questions flooding in. Method wants to know who would have instructed Courtney. Would that have been the handlers?
Yeah. Yeah. They would have manipulated her or instructed her, you know, on how to do things. But she, you know, again, wouldn't have known exactly what everything she was doing, except, you know, they just guided her in whatever she did to do what she did. I mean, she was brutally violent against Kathy Hanna of Bikini Kill, great musician. She punched her in the face at Lollapalooza out of nowhere, and Sonic Youth threatened to leave as headliners for that Lollapalooza tour when they saw that, because they were good friends with Kathleen Hanna. And she, you know, would grab photographers or journalists she didn't like and drag them around by the hair, you know, female photographers or journalists. And, you know, there was all kinds of lawsuits against her, but in charge, you know, but no charges went through for all of her brutality against so many other people.
Andrew wants to know, did you hear about her kidnapping her daughter's husband and almost having him killed?
Yes. That's an interesting case. Because some of her handlers, yeah, I forget the guy's name, but yeah, one of her managers, I believe, or talent people, PR people, I forget the guy's name now, was involved in that, directly involved in that. And, you know, in basically kidnapping and trying to take things from her daughter's husband. And there was a big lawsuit by him over that. And hopefully that's going to reveal a lot more. But I don't even know where that's gone at this point in time. I just, there's so many details of it all. And I'm just, yeah, I moved on to other subjects, you know, by that point in time.
Jake wants to know what specific evidence links her to the CIA.
Yeah, so I said some of them, but I'll say them again for sure. I don't mind. No question's a bad question here, guys. So thanks for the questions. So one of them is that her biological father, Hank Harrison, said that somebody befriended him when he was doing writing a book and doing research on a book in Ireland. He was a therapist and a writer, actually, this guy, Hank Harrison. And he's in Ireland. She comes to stay with him in Ireland. And some guy named Stephen O'Leary had befriended Hank Harrison, saying, oh, I love the Grateful Dead. And Hank Harrison used to be a manager for the Grateful Dead when they first started. And so Harrison said he didn't really think much of this guy. But he introduced him to his daughter. This guy starts sleeping with the 17-year-old, you know, daughter of Hank Harrison's, because Courtney Love was sleeping with tons of people. I mean, 17, it's not a big deal, except she was a prostitute by that time for the Japanese mafia, according to her different biographies on her. And so nonetheless, she was carrying 1,000 hits of acid. And here this older, you know, this guy in his late 20s or so, Stephen O'Leary, takes her to London, and where she distributes this acid to top musicians, you know, I'm sorry, in England, you know, through in top English music scenes. And so that's one. And so on his deathbed, Stephen O'Leary said, I was actually working for U.S. intelligence at that time. Said I was visiting the, you know, I didn't really have a high position, but I had to visit the embassy, U.S. embassy, once a week to give reports on people. So he was spying in Ireland for U.S. intelligence. And that's, you know, so he was connected to U.S. intelligence, most likely CIA, because of this kind of activities that CIA is involved in, like MKUltra, you know, with passing out, you know, LSD and stuff. The second link, though, is the fact that Jeff Epstein was found to be part of U.S. intelligence. President Trump's labor secretary, Alex Acosta, said that when he was vetted for his position, they said, well, why didn't you go to, you know, why didn't you work harder on the prosecution of Jeff Epstein at the time when he was prosecuting him in Florida early on when Jeff Epstein was taken to court in 2005. And he said, well, I was told that Epstein is U.S. intelligence and he's got a much higher pay grade than you do, so don't touch him. And so here is Epstein's U.S. intelligence. Courtney Love's circled as a material witness in what Epstein was doing in his black book. And Courtney Love, you know, was obviously involved with Jeffrey Epstein and what he's doing.
We're gonna have to leave that one. Actually, sent me messages.
I'm so sorry. You told me that. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. Adam Ant went bonkers, didn't he? Do you think Adam Ant was one of her victims?
Yeah, I think all of that scene, all of those musicians in that scene were victims. Yeah, Adam Ant, the drummer for the Pogues. There was some other Echo and the Bunnymen. They were all, you know, targets for Courtney Love, yes.
Imogen wants to know why Kurt didn't see through Courtney. Kurt was ridiculously intelligent.
I agree. Kurt was ridiculously intelligent. And I think he did see through Courtney. And that's why he was divorcing her at the time of his death. You know, I have in my film, you know, I have his lawyer saying, you know, basically that he was divorcing her and all. And that was, you know, recorded by Tom Grant, the investigator. And so the problem was Kurt Cobain was just too nice of a guy that when, you know, Courtney Love did the old kind of trick of getting pregnant early on in their dating, he decided, well, he's going to do the right thing and marry her. And but then when she was just so caustic and terrible in their marriage, he you know, had said he had to divorce her, and he was divorcing her. And that's what happened. Yeah.
Kim Smith wants to know if Courtney has a child.
Yeah, I mean that, you know, Kurt and Courtney do have a child together who's an adult who we were talking about got married to that other musician, and you know, Frances Bean Cobain, her name is.
Okay, and Linda wants to know why the CIA could not just use hypnosis without the abuse.
Well, they find that it takes a few different kinds of you know, ritual kind of techniques that help, you know, someone become an asset. And only certain people, like that, here only 10% of the population is so open to hypnosis that they can just use hypnosis. But with most people, they find it takes drugs and hypnosis.
Kim wants to know if Courtney's mother is a therapist.
Courtney's mother appears to be similar to her daughter, is my understanding. Because she ends up being a therapist, yes, for some interesting people, like one of the members of the Weather Underground. She was a therapist for one of them, and that's similar to like Dr. Jolyon West, who was a psychiatrist and a psychiatrist for Jack Ruby after he shot Lee Harvey Oswald, who was supposedly, you know, JFK's, President Kennedy's assassin. And so, yeah, I think she's a therapist that controls some political victims. Yeah.
C. Wired wants to know, where was Courtney when Kurt died?
Courtney was getting herself arrested in Los Angeles at the time to take away suspicion from her being involved. But she had a group of men that were at her home that appeared to be involved. And that group of male heroin addicts who Kurt Cobain tried to fire, apparently drugged Kurt with diazepam, with like a benzodiazepine, and then, you know, grabbed him and, you know, forced things to happen to him, you know, such as killing him.
Yeah. Steven wants to know, did the other Nirvana band members know what was going on?
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't think so, but I just can't. I really don't know.
All right. We've now got about, I know you've got so many subjects you can talk about. We'd love to get you back, John. Thanks. Let's, for the rest of it, let's go over to JFK then, shall we? Because that's what we've scheduled.
And Sean, I know about censorship, so please keep cutting me off if I you know, get into things that can get you censored. It's a tough world out there these days for us people trying to get the truth out.
Yeah. I think we're safer with JFK than
So these are sad, you know, tragic subjects from, you know, about people we love and people love Cobain. I loved, you know, Cobain was a incredible talent, incredible person. And of course, JFK, President John F. Kennedy. Thanks, Annabelle. So I was going to say that President John F. Kennedy was just so much more unbelievable than I realized when I started researching all his history. And I in my Drugs as Weapons Against Us book, I got a little bit into the JFK assassination, but I really covered more of, you know, more, put more pages into Robert F. Kennedy's assassination, because there was such a clear MKUltra tie on that, you know, CIA MKUltra tie to his assassination, because Sirhan Sirhan was, according to a Harvard specialist, Harvard psychiatrist, he was clearly hypnotized. And this Harvard psychiatrist spent 500 hours studying, examining Sirhan Sirhan, and said that, yeah, hypnosis was used and, you know, drugs were used to create Sirhan Sirhan as a, you know, patsy for Robert Kennedy's assassination.
Let me just interrupt you there briefly, John, because we just interviewed a guy called Joey Torres, T-O-R-R-E-S. We did 3-4 podcasts with him. He served 10 years with Sirhan Sirhan. And I'll send you over what he said about Sirhan, because it ties into what you're saying there.
Okay, thanks, Sean. So that sounds really interesting. So I ended up, of course, studying, you know, John F. Kennedy a bit, but I befriended a guy named the late John Judge, was a big researcher on President John F. Kennedy's assassination, and held annual conferences And developed a group called the Committee on Political Assassinations that had Cyril Wecht as part of it. I mentioned Cyril Wecht about Cobain's case. Cyril Wecht was a top medical examiner in the country, and also studied. He's in his 80s now, so he was of age. He was a professional when JFK was assassinated, President Kennedy was assassinated, and he studied the autopsy on President Kennedy. And so he came out in a new film, a documentary series, like a four-hour documentary about JFK by Oliver Stone. And so Oliver Stone hired a writer named Jim DiEugenio to write that documentary that ended up being 4 hours. And so they first turned into a 2-hour release nationally and maybe internationally, but then a year or two later, they released the 4-hour version. And so I wrote a film review of the 2-hour version, and Jim DiEugenio just liked what I wrote and asked me, could I please review the 4-hour version? So I ended up doing that, and it was basically amazing to hear President John F. Kennedy's history as a senator. He visited Vietnam in 1951 with his brother Robert Kennedy, who was his top aide, even back then as a senator. And they came back just saying, this is terrible what imperialism is doing in Vietnam, the French are doing in Vietnam, and we should not get involved, basically. And then he also, as a senator, spoke out against colonization and imperialism by the U.S. and other countries on the Senate floor. He gave a radical speech like that in 1957 as a senator, and he was shunned by Democrats and Republicans alike. And that's who he was before he became president. It's pretty amazing. I could not imagine today a senator speaking out so, bluntly and directly against, American and European imperialism, in other countries this way. And so by the time he reached, the presidency, he did run on a somewhat, basically a more moderate platform to reach the presidency. But once he was in, he first was pushed very hard by lots of powerful forces to continue with an operation that was already afoot to invade Cuba because of the Cuban Revolution. So he agreed to do it, but he would not allow any aerial strikes by any planes. And, it's possible he did that on purpose, and the CIA hated him for that, because it was obviously the Bay of Pigs was a big defeat. But he was pushed into doing it by the CIA. He fired the CIA director, at that point in time, Alan Dulles, because of the whole debacle, but wouldn't allow air coverage for that invading force. And when President Kennedy was assassinated, Fidel Castro said, this is a terrible day for Cuba and the world. As much as Castro was upset, of course, about him, but the Bay of Pigs, Castro knew that he was the best that America could offer. He was brokering deals with Nikita Khrushchev. He was calling for the disarmament of all nuclear arms, dismantling of nuclear arms. He was just doing a lot of great things. When I said before, he dismantled MK Ultra. That was major. He was calling for peace with the Soviet Union. He had a speech calling for national health care in the United States, which never happened, but for him to call for that in the early 1960s is amazing. He says all the European countries have national health insurance. Every industrialized country basically has national health insurance except for the US. And, he pointed that out in speeches. And so there was lots of reasons for the oligarchs, the corporate, owners, multinational corporate owners in our country, the wealthiest in our country, to hate him for these things. He also was, first he thought that he allowed what the generals wanted, which was some incursions in Vietnam. But then he started pulling troops back out of Vietnam and he announced that we are going to have all troops and leaving Vietnam within a year. And so I have all that evidence of him doing that in my book and film, Drugs as Weapons Against Us. And that was a big issue because Vietnam was part of the golden triangle for opium and opium crops, and which produces white, lots of white throughout the world. You know, it's the biggest trafficker of white throughout the world, of opium and all throughout the world. And so the powers that be, I show evidence that they've been long involved in opium throughout the world. You know, the wealthiest in our country and Britain with the British East India, you know, company, they were always, you know, connected. And the wealthiest in our country are often called Anglophiles because they love the royalty of Britain. And they were all involved in the opium trade and still are. And they're still being J.P. Morgan boats, you know, owned boats were caught with other forms of white from, you know, Latin America, and with tons of white in there, you know, transporting, trafficking tons of white. And so this is what, you know, we're dealing with. And yeah, you know, I'm glad Bjor just said about the opium wars in Afghanistan. So the two, you know, longest wars in U.S. history were Vietnam and Afghanistan. And it's no coincidence that they're the sites for the two best opium producing, you know, like poppy producing areas in the world. You know, they call them the Golden Triangle for poppies in, you know, Vietnam area, and the Golden Crescent for poppy production, you know, poppy growing in the Afghanistan area. And so, yeah, that's part of why they assassinated him. Now, if you look at the assassin, you know, the purported assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, he was working for the U.S. government on the U-2 plane, spy plane project before he was, you know, purported to be the assassin of President Kennedy. And then you look at Jack Ruby, who killed Lee Harvey Oswald, the patsy, just a few days later. And Jack Ruby was an FBI informant. Okay, he was working. I mean, he was paid by the FBI. And so this came out from a senator who was investigating this. You know, U.S. senator was investigating this, named Schweitzer, and he said that he was told by FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover that you know, that Jack Ruby was a paid FBI informant. So this is some of the way it all works. And you know, the CIA was all over basically that assassination. You know, you had just so many different, now, you know, in the documentary, they interview Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who says that his dad, the first thing he did after that RFK, I mean, after his brother was assassinated, was he called the CIA and he said, tell me, you know, who was behind this horror in your agency, basically, you know. And and then they had two war veterans who were, you know, part of security for JFK in the car behind JFK when he was assassinated. And they both said there was a crossfire of bullets that killed JFK, President Kennedy, and not the one lone assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, from the sixth floor building behind JFK. And witnesses in that building said that Lee Harvey Oswald was not on the sixth floor from the place they said he was to kill, you know, JFK. And then you have a police expert saying that, you know, that the gun that he originally found was not the same gun they said was used in the trial, you know, like they brought out as evidence of the gun that killed JFK. And so there's so many different points of evidence that you can see in, you know, in this 4-hour documentary to show that this was all covered up. JFK had hired a black security guard, you know, basically, you know, appointed a black security guard to be part of his detail. And that black security guard said he had evidence to show that it was, you know, multiple gunmen that killed President Kennedy. And so when he came out with that, they jailed him for some frivolous thing and shut him up. So there's just, you know, there's that, there was the doctors that, that looked at President Kennedy right after he was shot. They said it was clearly a bullet that came in through his throat, the front of his throat, and also came in through the front of his head. And that's what they first said. And then they came, you know, people came down him and said, no, you have to change that to the back. And so he was forced the next day to change it to the back. But two people that were close with that doctor said he admitted that, yeah, they made him change what he, you know, what he examined, what he said about the bullet entry wounds in his examination of JFK's body after the assassination.
Didn't a piece of his head end up on the car and his wife scrambled out and grabbed it?
Well, I don't believe his head like ended. I don't think it came completely off now and ended up on the car, but
a piece, like a fragment or something.
Oh yeah. Yeah. A piece might've come off for sure. Yeah. No doubt. And she was just, I don't know if she grabbed it, but I know she was filled with blood on her coat. And she, and after, you know, after the assassination, she said, they said, don't you want to change your coat when you speak to, you know, on camera after this all happened? And she said, no, I'm not changing my coat. I want to, you know, show the world what they did to him. And she said they did to him. She knew it was multiple gunmen and she knew it was powerful forces that did this. It wasn't one lone assassin. She knew that from the start. She knew, you know, she could see, you know, hear, experience these bullets whizzing in front of President Kennedy coming at him and from all different angles. And that's what it was. It was a crossfire that killed Kennedy, just like his, you know, aides and backup who were, you know, veterans of combat said, you know, I mean, his security detail behind him. So, yeah. And, you know, and then you got the magic bullet, which supposedly came in through the back of Kennedy, went through, you know, hit, like injured two or three different parts of Kennedy, and then jumped to the front, to the seat in front of him, and injured two different parts of Senator, you know, I mean, his vice president, you know. And so that's, you know, that's the good old magic bullet that Cyril Weck talked about. The path was ridiculous, and then the bullet magically comes out unscathed, you know, of the second person it hits, you know, in three different places. And so it was obviously a crossfire and a number of bullets to make sure the assassination was successful. And so, of course, once they got rid of JFK, they had Lyndon Johnson in their pocket, and Johnson just reversed of, you know, John Kennedy's policies and, you know, pushed for the Vietnam War to escalate in a big way and, you know, and ended any kind of peace detente with the Soviet Union, et cetera.
All right, so we've got about 10 minutes left with John. If you've got any questions on JFK only, put them in the chat, because there's probably going to be quite a few, and we're going to run out of time here. Do you think, John, that LBJ had foreknowledge?
Yeah, I don't know for sure. My guess is yes. He apparently didn't like Kennedy. And his brother, is my understanding, he was, you know, more of a political pick for vice president. And I think he probably did have some foreknowledge in some way, shape, or form. So yeah, I'm sorry. And the person in front of Kennedy wasn't Johnson. The vice president was somebody else. I think a senator from Texas. Maybe, but nonetheless, I do think he probably had foreknowledge. I don't know for sure, though. My guess is that he did have some foreknowledge. I've heard evidence that he did, so he probably did.
Very funny question, Papa, but we've got to stick to JFK questions only, please. So, John, what was the role of the Cold War in this?
Well, you know, it's all these American oligarchs wanted to, you know, have a heightened war with Soviet Union. They wanted just constant America to be on war footing so they can make so much money off of weapons, so that they can control Americans easier by pretending like there's a constant menace, you know. I think that those were major issues. And the fact that JFK was thawing the Cold War in a big way that played a part in their motives to assassinate him.
And how many Kennedys were assassinated?
That's a good question. Well, I've got, you know, there's massive evidence, of course, on President John F. Kennedy and Senator Robert F. Kennedy, who was about to become president before he was assassinated, because he had won the California primary right before his assassination. And that was a sign that he was going to win the Democratic primary. And he just was just too popular. There's no way anyone was going to defeat him for president. And so it's clear cut on those two. Now, I've read and seen evidence of several attempts on Ted Kennedy's life also. And I don't think, I think that's not just, can't be just a coincidence. You know, as he was probably, they were worried about his influence as a really a popular senator. And he could have been president. I think people in the Democratic Party had to organize in a special way to keep him from being the presidential candidate. I heard in when it was him against President Carter, and granted, President Carter was one of our better presidents, you know, relatively speaking, he was definitely one of our best presidents since JFK. But nobody was going to be, you know, like a Kennedy. The Kennedys were much more progressive in a positive way, you know, like than any other candidates. And so there was a huge fight in the primary between Carter and Ted Kennedy. And I think it was 1976. And I heard there was a huge fight about that, who was going to be the candidate. And the Carter people won that fight. But I think it was similar to like Bernie Sanders being the most popular candidate, you know, in the, you know, in the recent elections. There was no way they were going to let Bernie Sanders be the nominee for the Democratic Party. And because he was the most popular, you know, American candidate running, no doubt. And so it was a similar situation. They were not going to let Ted Kennedy get near the presidency.
Question from Jake.
I'll just add one more answer to that is I do think that John F. Kennedy Jr. was assassinated also, but that's more controversial than the others, believe it or not. Okay,
Jake wants to know why no major whistleblowers have come forward. Weren't they all killed? Weren't hundreds of people killed around this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, members of the Warren Commission even were killed, is my understanding, is what I've heard. But yeah, I think witnesses were shut up or done away with, you know. Yeah, I think there was other people killed too. But I'm sorry, what were we going to say, Sean?
Even members of the Warren Commission were killed?
Yeah, it's my understanding. Ones that went against things that happened, you know, there that kind of opposed the way, you know, it was being manipulated. But I don't have all the, you know, remember all the evidence of that. So I can't get into that deeply. I'm sorry.
Nitram said it was Texas Governor John Connally sat in front of Kennedy.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ray J has a question for you, John. Was the death of JFK the final takeover move by the deep state and the end of democracy?
Well, it was major, no doubt. Probably one of the biggest, you know, events. You know, you can call it the deep state, you can call it whatever. The deep state, that idea, that term actually came from a professor over here, Peter Dale Scott, who's Canadian originally, but was a Canadian diplomat and then became a University of California, Berkeley professor, who's written excellent books about drugs and politics that I've used for sources for my book. But so, you know, Trump kind of took over that term, but it's an important term. It's really, you know, just like the idea of U.S. intelligence having too much control over our country and thus having too much, you know, power, you know, with British intelligence or Tavistock Institute in Britain over the world. But yeah, it was a major, definitely, maybe it's arguably the most important, you know, takeover democracy. But, you know, other people might argue that 9/11 was the biggest usurpation of democracy.
We've only got 2-3 minutes left. If you've got any final questions for John, squeeze them in there now. We'll try and do short answers to get through them. Method wants to know if the Kennedys were involved in Marilyn Monroe's murder.
Well, there, you know, some people make that speculation, and I don't believe it's the case. I mean, there were so many attempts. You know, when you got political targets like the Kennedys, in the same way, you know, I'm not saying that they weren't promiscuous, and you know that maybe JFK or RFK or whoever didn't sleep with Marilyn Monroe. It's certainly possible, but no, I don't believe that they murdered her. I think that they, you know, there was an attempt to smear the Kennedys with the murder of Marilyn Monroe. And just because they were such targets, you know, for U.S. intelligence, and the kind of the evidence that I've seen when, you know, that the Kennedys were behind Marilyn Monroe's death it's bad sources. It's sources that are police connected, that are have biases, that, you know, and police, even local police are connected to U.S. intelligence. Police intelligence units overlap with the FBI. There's FBI agents that are in our country, they're both police and FBI, and I document that in my books, the FBI War on Tupac Shakur, and as well as Drugs as Weapons Against Us. So I think they planted evidence to pretend the Kennedys were involved, but I don't believe they were involved.
We still have a few questions. Can we just do very short answers on these ones? We've got Harjit. Are you willing to believe the victim was a JFK body double?
No.
Rebecca, was Lee Harvey Oswald really assassinated?
Yes, by Jack Ruby.
Was JFK on the UFO files? Onto the UFO files.
I don't know what the UFO files are.
All right, let's see. Excellent interview. Conspiracy. All right, we have actually almost run out of time, John. All right, so can people contact you on your socials and ask you questions and follow you?
Yeah. Go to John Potash, JohnPotash.com, or it's also titled drugsasweapons.com, and you can contact me through that website for sure, and I'll respond to your questions if you'd like. But you can see all my films and all my books, you know, on that website, as well as other articles and other issues on that website.
And Ash has just sent me a little note as one of our most best received guests by the viewers, John. He's apparently going to invite you onto our 100th episode, which is 3 weeks from now, I believe. So
that'd be great. Thanks so much, John and Ash, for that. That'd be great.
Oh, I really appreciate that. You take care, my friend.
You do the same, Sean. Thanks again for having me on.
All right. Cheers, John. Bye.